Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'll take a couple of minutes and wrap up the week that was. We'll walk you through the Fed's thinking on inflation, and we'll tell you about the new way that teachers are buying their school supplies. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 12th of December. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. One might reasonably have thought things would be slowing down economy-wise as the holidays approached. One would, however, have been wrong had one thought that. We've got consumer news, congressional news, commodities news, a little bit of everything for our weekly wrap. Here to do that with us are Catherine Rempel from The Washington Post and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hello to you both.
Hey, Kai.
All
right, Sudeep, late last night, the Congress finally wraps up its big spending bill. We all know how that went. My question is about the thing that almost jammed it up, the swaps push-out provision, the rollback of part of Dodd-Frank. Why and how did we wind up doing that in that bill that had to pass?
We ended up doing that because that's how Congress works. It doesn't actually make decisions that are based on hearings and serious contemplation anymore. It does things at the spur of the moment in terms of serious legislation that isn't must-pass. That's the only thing, something like a provision like that, only way it would have gotten through. So it's actually highly debatable whether this is going to prove to be a serious long-term issue. There are people, Democrats and Republicans, who have interesting cases to make, but it actually has done something useful, I think, which is highlight how derivatives are a very big deal for our financial system. It's they're the hardest thing to understand in our global financial system, and there are some very legitimate derivatives, and then there are a whole lot of grenades hiding behind them, and if the grenades blow up, at least we will know that we've been warned at a moment like this.
Yeah, and it's a really big market, too, the derivatives market. Catherine, do you think it was so this is a perception question, right? I mean, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, was calling members of Congress to advocate for the passage of this bill. Do you think it was smart for the banks to be this open about what they wanted to have happen?
I mean, I think they've been pretty open about this along.
How about bald? How about bald about how they wanted that?
I guess. I mean, they've been lobbying to water down Dodd-Frank for basically since it was passed, before it was passed.
Yeah.
So this is an ongoing strategy. And, you know, I saw this headline today saying that that this swaps piece that got through is evidence of Wall Street's resurgent influence in Washington. And my feeling is kind of, when did their influence wane? You know?
Yeah. Sudeep, what do you think about that point?
Their influence did wane for a moment in 2010 when a big bill passed that they didn't want. But Wall Street still has plenty of influence over lawmakers. But there are some perception concerns that many members have. They don't want to be seen as too close to Wall Street. There are people on the left who are going to face primaries in the next election cycle, and they want to be able to fight Wall Street and say that they're against the big banks. And so that was the moment, but we've moved on beyond that. And when the economy is looking better, Wall Street feels like it has more power.
Well, Catherine, about the economy looking better, the rest of the world is in a little bit of trouble, right? Things are slowing down pretty much everywhere else except here. And the consumer economy in this country, with consumer sentiment up today, retail sales were up earlier this week, the consumer economy is zipping right along. How is that happening?
Well, we have a few things going for us. Unemployment has been falling here. That's not really true in a lot of other parts of the world. GDP growth has been picking up. You know, there are a lot of measures on which the economy has been improving. Not all of them. You know, wages are still pretty flat, although we did see some improvement recently. So all of that builds into how consumers view the economy, they view the world around them, and how they feel about their pocketbooks and whether they can be spending this holiday season.
Sudeep, let me do a little bit of, instead of wrapping up the week that was, play it forward a little bit. The Fed meets next week. We've got a spot coming up here from Annie Baxter in a minute about the Fed's inflation targets. But what do you think they are looking at now, Janet Yellen and the gang, as they get ready to meet and think about when to raise rates? Are they looking at how things are going here, or are they looking at how things are going in the rest of the world? Where's the obligation line?
They seem to be focused right now on what's happening here, and that's a very important distinction. The Fed has been arguing all along that they have to be concerned about the U.S. economy. They can't be responsible for everyone else's problems, and this will be the test to see whether the Fed is actually going to go in that direction. They are looking at a huge drop in oil prices as being a good thing for the U.S. economy, and they are trying to to basically look at this and say, and look through the noise. There were moments when oil prices were going up where people would blame the Fed and say, oh, don't they drive cars? Don't they eat food? All these things. Right, and they look at core inflation to separate food and energy that's most volatile. This is their moment now to say, we're going to look through the volatile elements and focus on what's actually happening under the surface. And at least for now, the U.S. economy is looking okay compared to the rest of the world. Their big test is whether their forecast is going to hold up and whether the rest of the world is going to start dragging us down.
Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He is in Washington, D.C. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. She is in New York. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, take it easy. On Wall Street today, well, really, you just don't want to know. We'll tell you anyway, but you're not going to want to know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So about the Federal Reserve and inflation and rates. If you are one of the people out there worried about inflation, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has a message for you. Don't sweat it so much. The Bureau's gauge of prices at the wholesale level that came out this morning showed a gain of just 1.4% for the year that ended in November. In other words, not very much. It's the smallest annual increase in months and well below, in fact, the 2% mark for inflation that the Federal Reserve is looking for. The Fed, yes, that's true, wants prices to be higher than they are right now. If you're wondering why, here's Marketplace's Annie Baxter.
The Fed's target inflation rate is kind of a Goldilocks number. If prices heat up too much, people burn up a lot more of their incomes buying stuff.
Oh, that's too hot.
But if prices fall, businesses lose money. Maybe they lay people off. The economy suffers.
That's too cold.
A little bit of inflation seems to be the sweet spot.
Robert Dye is chief economist at Comerica Bank.
And that's just right.
Dye says it's hard to know just how much inflation is right because of what goes into the calculation. Energy prices have fallen recently.
But it's a real mixed current. House prices and rents have been going up, and that's a big part of consumer inflation.
The Fed wants all those rising and falling prices to net out to 2% inflation. But why that number? Alan Blinder, an economics professor at Princeton University and a former central bank official, says, well, good question.
Nobody really knows what the right number is.
But Blinder says there's a lot of consensus around 2%. Other central banks use it too. And Blinder says part of the reason for picking that number and sticking with it is just to create clear expectations about how fast prices will rise. You don't want to keep changing the target.
Confusing people as if the length of the yardstick was changing every year.
But some economists say you also want to avoid falling consistently short of that target, which has been happening for years now in the U.S. Blinder argues that's a sign the Fed should keep stimulating the economy to try to nudge the inflation rate up a bit. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We'll make a pivot now from inflation to debt, consumer debt to be just a bit more specific. The Federal Reserve says U.S. household debt is growing, but debt as compared to income is as low as it's been in 3 years and much lower here than it is in places like Britain or Canada. Tim Fitzsimmons has the Marketplace Debt Report.
Economists would tell you debt isn't a dirty word. An increase in borrowing means an increase in spending, which means an increase in demand, which helps the economy. But too much debt and bad debt, well, that's where people found themselves in the recession.
So households went through a very painful process of deleveraging in the last couple of years.
Bernie Baumol is an economist at the Economic Outlook Group. Deleveraging is the key word here.
But the bottom line is they're trying to restore some balance between the amount of debt that they've got to service and the income that they're making.
But having your own financial house in order doesn't necessarily help the overall economy, says Gus Fauché, an economist with PNC Financial Services.
It's been a drag on economic growth as consumers have been more cautious with their spending.
But now that many Americans have largely dug themselves out of the holes created by the Great Recession, economists expect an uptick in debt and in spending.
I think there is room for consumers to take on a little bit more debt, not go hog wild, but take on some more credit to fund purchases of big ticket items.
While many Americans have stabilized their balance sheets, Thomas Cooley, a business professor at NYU's Stern School, says young people have staggered under the weight of growing student debt.
And that's a constraining factor in their ability and their willingness to take on mortgage debt and more auto loan debt and so on.
So that's one reason why the millennials are sometimes called Generation Rent. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Hachette, the publishing house, did a little experiment this week. It offered for sale 100 copies of Amanda Palmer's autobiographical book, The Art of Asking, along with a signed copy of the manuscript page, just as a bonus. The product itself, though, wasn't the experiment. The point of sale was. Those 100 copies, which sold out in 20 minutes, by the way, were available only via a buy button on Hachette's Twitter account. From New York, Nova Sappho has more on a move to bypass traditional booksellers.
Through its various imprints, Hachette publishes some 1,000 books a year. Its Twitter experiment, though, is limited to just 3 books.
We are always looking for ways to connect our writers with their readers.
Heather Fain heads marketing strategy at Hachette.
And selling people books through Twitter where they're already talking about books seemed like a very simple and direct way to do that.
But here's the big elephant in the room, Amazon. Hachette just settled a very public spat with the online retailer and won the ability to set its own prices on Amazon's website.
Are you looking for new ways to distribute so you're not so beholden to Amazon?
Well, I think this really is just an example of a new way to communicate with consumers. They're just not connected.
Amazon and iTunes, all these marketplaces have done amazing things.
Ryan Delk is with Gumroad, the San Francisco-based tech startup which powers the buy button on Hachette's Twitter page. While the book publisher may be focused on social media marketing, Gumroad is thinking e-commerce. It's been courting authors and musicians, offering them a platform to sell their content online without using iTunes or Amazon.
There's a lot of opportunities for Gumroad and for a lot of other companies to be able to do things that will empower creators to be able to make more money, get more data from their transactions, understand their audience better.
Hachette, for example, will get the email addresses of its Twitter book buyers, allowing the publisher to develop a direct connection with readers.
It's an interesting experiment. It won't serve as a direct alternative to Amazon.
Digital media market analyst Michael Wolff says Hachette and Gumroad are far from matching Amazon's scale. But he says it makes sense for Hachette to be thinking about how to rely on Amazon less in the long term.
If you're Hachette and you're looking at the future of your business, you don't want to put all your eggs certainly in one basket. Now, I think that the traditional book buying public is not necessarily used to buying books through Twitter by any means, so it'll be interesting to see where this goes.
Hachette started its Twitter campaign with authors who have millions of followers. The publisher says where it's likely to go next is to see if authors with fewer followers can also sell on this new non-Amazon platform. In New York, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up,
everyone's talking about the new iPad Air 2. It's the must-buy gift to bring mom to the 21st century. And if you fail?
No, man, you do not want to go there. But first, let's do the numbers. I think that's 2 days out of 3 with the wah-wah trombones, you guys. I don't know. The Dow Industrial's off 315 points today, 1.75%, closed at 17,280. The NASDAQ dropped 54 points, 1.1%, 46.53. At the bell, the S&P 500 gave back 33 points, 1.6%, ended things at 2,002. For the week, the Dow off 3.7%, the NASDAQ down 2.7%, the S&P 500 lost 3.5%. Oil, of course, was the story of the day and the week on Wall Street. The International Energy Agency today cut its estimate for global growth in oil demand. Thus, oil prices continued their slide. Light crude still trading below $60 a barrel. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note. Get a load of this, down to 2.08%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and believe me when I tell you that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice. That's thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. And thank you so much for your support. Also, this is Kai Rizdal, in case you didn't know who this was.
from the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for November. Are you checking things off your holiday to-do list? The U.S. Postal Service anticipates Monday will be its busiest mailing day of the year. And Gone with the Wind premiered in Atlanta on December 15, 1939. We here at Datebook headquarters appreciate Scarlett O'Hara's final line, "Tomorrow is another day." I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked about oil a little bit up in the wrap and in the numbers as well, what falling prices and falling demand might mean macroeconomically. But there is also a very real logistical side to this story. A lot of countries, including us, have started to stockpile cheap oil on the hopes that prices are going to turn higher. The technical term for that is the crude inventories have increased, which leads to the non-technical question of where do they put all of it? Marketplace's Adam Allington has that story.
U.S. oil producers currently have 380 million barrels of inventory sloshing around the country, which isn't an all-time high, but it's pretty close. John Wilson is a consultant at the University of Michigan Energy Institute. He says finding a place to park all this oil is no simple task.
The answer is you store it anywhere you can find a place to put it. Tanks, of course, rail cars, tankers on the high seas, little tankers running around the coast.
Wilson says storing oil on rail cars and tankers is an effective temporary solution, but eventually producers will have to make a decision about scaling back production.
It's a fairly serious decision. You don't just start and stop these things without a consequence.
Mark Rout works for the energy consultancy KBC. A traditional oil well, he says, is usually not as productive after it's been shut down. Shale oil, however, requires drilling lots and lots of wells so they can adjust production more easily.
Just wait until you need it, and then we'll drill it at that point. And the consequences on the production and on the field are not as dire as on the conventional oil.
Some producers might be pushed out of the market as prices continue to drop and inventories rise.
One of the things that we don't know is where their break-even costs are.
Tim Hess is a petroleum market analyst at the U.S. Energy Information Administration. He says even if some producers do leave, he still expects overall production to increase next year. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
If you had a spare $400 to spend on whatever you wanted, what would it be? A weekend getaway? A new flat-screen TV? Clothes, maybe? How about spending it where you work? Yeah, no, I didn't think so. And yet there is an industry where workers spend an average of more than $400 a year on the job out of their own pockets. Teachers. They are buying paper and pencils sometimes, yes, but also actual educational content, handouts and worksheets and lesson plans. And they are buying it increasingly from a source you might not expect. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has that story.
You gotta go.
The East New York Middle School of Excellence takes up the second floor of a brick fortress in one of Brooklyn's poorest neighborhoods. Between periods, Devin Whittam is walking up and down the tiled hallways, looking for a laptop, hustling late students.
Get to class, please, you guys.
And beating herself up over last period, when she did a lesson on pronouns for some of her English language learners, native speakers of Arabic, Spanish, and Bengali.
I felt like it was too hard for my newcomer and too easy for the kid who's been here for 2 years, and I think probably was right at the right level for one student.
Is that a relative success or?
No. I mean, ultimately, no.
Whittam, like every other teacher in New York's public schools, is supposed to get all these kids to the same level, the same set of middle school Common Core standards, even when a seventh grader is currently reading English at a first grade level. And the school doesn't have a curriculum for that.
When I feel like the expectations on me feel impossible, it's easy to sort of get really angry. But at the same time, I'm the teacher. I'm the one who is ultimately determining how good of an education they're getting.
Last year, she worked through lunch and late at night, planning up to 6 different lessons a day. And when that got unsustainable, like millions of her colleagues, she looked for help online.
So I have 17 things that I purchased last year.
She bought reading guides, worksheets, a game for second graders where kids pull facts out of a bag and guess the main idea that unites them.
Oh, yeah, I remember this one. I used this with a few students, actually.
Because the school only reimburses a small fraction of teacher expenses, Whittem bought all this with her own money. But she didn't buy it on Amazon or from some big publisher like Pearson. She bought it through TeachersPayTeachers.com, an online marketplace where the sellers are other teachers.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome.
Like Chris Cadalzo.
So this is my store.
From her laptop in her uptown Manhattan apartment, she sells math lessons.
My bestseller is the third grade fraction unit. I've sold 452 of them.
And so that comes to $5,658.
Yeah, 2 cents.
It sounds like a windfall. Until you divide by the 200 hours it took to turn her teaching notes into that polished downloadable package. And the hundreds more hours spent on her blog, Facebook, Pinterest, to make her fraction unit stand out in a field of more than a million products.
It's so much work and so much time, and it's really a huge investment.
But an investment that's paying off for a lot of teachers. Cadalzo's store averages $3,000 a month, and she's not even in the top 500 sellers on Teachers Pay Teachers. Adam Fried is the website's CEO.
Last year, our community transacted about $45 million worth of classroom materials.
If it were a publishing company, it would be in the middle tier of its market, according to industry analyst Kathy Mickey.
A $45 million company is a decent-sized company.
And this year, it'll be nearly double that, and we see the growth rates only accelerating.
Well, that would be, I mean, yes, then they're becoming a major player.
The fact that they're selling so much is kind of mind-boggling.
Sam Abramovich is a professor of education informatics who's studied the website.
In the sense that the funds for this are not coming from school districts. They're not coming from textbook publishers. This is teachers spending money out of their own pocket.
He thinks that tells you two things.
It tells you, A, that teachers have this huge need for resources that are not being met through other means, and B, that they value resources created by each other.
Schools and school districts still look to the big publishing companies when they need a new textbook. But teachers, when they need to turn that text into a lesson that'll engage 25 kids in an East New York classroom, they increasingly look to other classrooms, and they're willing to pay for what they find. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
We don't usually do gift guides here at Marketplace, but maybe 2014 is the year we finally start. Or, at the very least, we'll offer some suggestions with the help of Sam Weiner and Daniel Kibblesmith, the authors of How to Win at Everything.
Every year brings a new wave of must-have holiday gifts, from Tickle Me Elmo in 1996 to the polio vaccine in 1956.
But this season, the stakes are higher than ever. Here are the holiday gifts your family literally cannot live without.
First, your kid is probably already begging you for their very own Disney's Frozen Sparkle Princess Elsa doll. But what you might not realize is if your child is the only kid at school without this coveted plaything, you're dooming them to life as a social pariah.
Friendless and desperate, their grades plummet, and by age 10, your child will become addicted to huffing packing peanuts and selling their own eyelashes under a bridge.
Their sullen face caked with regret, they wail long into adulthood the day you cursed them by buying them the wrong doll.
Next, everyone's talking about the new iPad Air 2. It's the must-buy gift to bring mom to the 21st century. And if you fail?
Mom will start missing crucial email updates, engagement announcements, wedding invitations, and priceless photos of her first grandchildren.
Soon, she'll be entirely cut off from the family, focusing her love on an ever-expanding family of stray feral cats.
In no time, she'll forget the English language entirely and start subsisting on a diet of leaves and injured birds.
If only you'd gotten her that iPad. You'd still have a mom instead of a gibbering cat queen. And here's a quick tip to remember which hot new video game console to buy for your teen. PlayStation 4, love evermore.
Xbox One, lose your son.
Yeah.
Finally, the gift your whole family desperately needs, a Sony 85-inch Ultra HD 3D television.
Without this glorious slab of distraction, your family will be condemned to the worst possible fate of the holiday season, enjoying each other's company.
Whatever you buy this holiday season, whether toy, gadget, or entertainment experience, remember that the real perfect gift is love. The love of buying things.
Sam Weiner and Daniel Kibblesmith with their take on your holiday shopping list. There is more of their wisdom at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the fall 2014 edition of the Journal of Economic Perspectives, an article entitled "The Wages of Sinistrality, Handedness, Brain Structure, and Human Capital," which is, I think, a long-winded social science way of saying that left-handed people make less money than right-handed people do. Lefties, the research shows, have median earnings about 10% below what righties make. And yes, I am a lefty. Just standing up for my people here. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow off 315 points, a terrible end to a terrible week on Wall Street. That's 1.75%. The NASDAQ off 54 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 gave back 33 points, 1.6%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend, all right? This is APM.